Welcome to The Lunch Podcast. I'm your regular host, James Rocky, and this week we're talking with Ann Thompson, author of the just-released book, The $11 Billion Year, From Sundance to the Oscars, An Inside Look at a Changing Hollywood System. Don't forget, The Lunch is brought to you by Snoot Films, makers of independent movies like The Guest. Hi, I'm James Rocky, and this is The Lunch Podcast. Every week, I dine with a creator or a critic in the world of film, and then after that midday meal, we talk about the concerns of the day. This week, it's very much my pleasure to have as my guest reporter, journalist, raconteur, Ann Thompson. You know her from her blog, Thompson on Hollywood, located at IndieWire, or perhaps from her Twitter feed, AK Stanwyck. She's also the author of the just-released book, The $11 Billion Year, From Sundance to the Oscars, An Inside Look at a Changing Hollywood System. I've read it, it's terrific, and it's very much my pleasure to have Ann as my guest this week. Hello, Ann, how are you?
I'm great, thanks, James.
The book was made available last night thanks to the miracle of Kindle, and I will also be vulgar enough to buy a physical copy, and I devoured it. And can we talk briefly about the big inspiration for the structure of the book, William Goldman's The Season?
Exactly. It is an unusually structured book, but I was always inspired. I wanted to do this for about 15 years. And he did a season on Broadway. And, you know, the London import, the revival, the Broadway musical, each chapter was devoted to a different kind of Broadway play, and it was one season. And so I thought, why not take a year in Hollywood, the way I cover it, you know, the way I report it every day for the blog, from January at Sundance to the Oscar night, the finale, and string all the stories throughout, the contenders, if you like, and different kinds of Hollywood movies.
So, and it covers more than the year in that you go all the way up to that Oscar season, and that was also a great movie year. Argo, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Zero Dark Thirty, a bunch of different things, and you're able to track them in some cases from, oh, this is playing Sundance, no one's heard of it, to the big night. You said you wanted to do this for 11 years. Was it just a function of finally having the time or going, ooh, no, 2011, that's an emblematic year?
No. So it was more like 15 years. And what happened was I did a proposal back then, and it didn't, you know, get anywhere. And the difference between then and now, I mean, it was just sitting, you know, somebody, you know, took me out for a drink, and an editor, this wonderful editor, Esther Margolis, who was going over to HarperCollins, starting a new imprint there, and she said, oh, what have you got? And I said, oh, I've always wanted to do, you know, and it was like butter. It was one of those things that was meant to happen. She said, give me a proposal. And I said, oh, proposals are so hard. And she says, no, just knock it out over the weekend. Yeah, she knew how to handle me. I don't know how to explain it to you. And I just knocked out using the other one, the old one, as a template. But I made it 2012. That was the year that was coming up. And I sold this idea that I could somehow blog, report, cover, and turn around in a very quick way. The book, and they bought it. I was perhaps naive, and they were perhaps naive, because of course it's way more difficult than it looks to turn that into a book, and it nearly killed me.
I'm a huge fan of super coherent, plain structure. Often when I'm doing an interview with somebody, I don't move the quotes for fear that, you know, a later answer will somehow be predicated on things that were talked about earlier, and moving will disrupt the flow of that. So the chronology of it is just really fascinating to me, because you don't skip around a lot. You stay in the moment as you would when you're covering it.
Yeah, I decided to. I that was a decision I made, to stay in the present tense. And then if I, you know, referred to something that happened in the past, I would go in the past. And that was a little tricky, but it seems to put you in the moment. That was the idea.
The other thing is, you are I can't even think of the adjective. You are a ceaseless reporter. You always have stuff on Thompson and Hollywood. Everything from new trailers with insight, to news with insight, to interviews. When you had sold the book, were you able to walk around and go, ooh, this I can keep for the book, and this will go up in a piece right now?
Yeah, I did. And I also did a lot of extra reporting as I went along. And I was thinking all the time, you know, this is the story that this is going to relate to. This is the story I need to do. I need to go talk to Adam Fogelson, then chairman of Universal, because he knows the backstory on the exhibitors and what's going on at CinemaCon. And I, you know, and what's going on with you know, the move to 35. You know, I needed, certain people needed to inform me of what, you know, the backstory was. And I went after those people. It was fun.
Did you find, like, that phone tree of human beings with whom to speak just expanding the deeper you got into the year?
Well, if I have any regrets at all, it's that I reported as much as I had time to do, and I still was running that blog. I hired more writers. I did get some backup, but it was hard. I skipped Cannes, which was painful, but I could have done more. I could have really done more if I'd had more time. But I didn't want it to get bogged down in too much detail. Sometimes you read movie books that people have just gone all the way. You know, they've just come up with every single detail about everything you've ever or perhaps never wanted to know.
Yeah, but a superfluosity of information should not be confused with actual insight.
So there are times and places in this book where I wished I could have gone a little deeper, but that was the best I could do at the time.
But I just feel like, you know, we live in an age where people publish so many think pieces that require so little actual thinking. It's like, oh, this rhetorical question, the obvious answer is no, but let's spend 1,000 words getting to it. And your book does not do that. It isn't laborious, it assumes a certain familiarity with the players, but it really limbs stuff in great, great detail. Were there moments when people were turning to and going, okay, don't write that down. Do you have enough to fill a second book with the dirt?
There's some other stuff on the cutting room floor, sure.
Yeah? We will not talk about that. Then the one thing you really talk about in the book extraordinarily well is the idea of the tentpole, the franchise, the big movie as strategy, which is becoming more and more, you know, certainly was the case in you know, the year the book delineates, but we're living in that time even now. You know, we've got 2 Marvel movies this year, we've got a superhero franchise from Fox, another one from Sony. We have all these huge movies. And I just keep on thinking about drunk poker players making these huge irrational bets, not knowing if they're going to win it. What happened to turn every studio into Teddy KGB from Rounders?
You know, it isn't so much of it seems like a risky gamble, but unfortunately, the reason they keep making it is that the statistics show that they get more back when one of these big movies win than they lose when one of them loses. And it's just, even Battleship, you know, which I write about in the book, they saw that coming. You know, they knew it was going to be bad. You know,
what do you mean bad? I think Battleship's a terrific action film.
You do?
I think Battleship does exactly what it says on the tin.
And I saw it.
I would much rather watch Battleship again than The Avengers, because one is about people and one is from a director who knows how to shoot action, and one is about action figures from a director who doesn't.
I would argue that Joss Whedon knows the characters really well and isn't such a good action director, and The Avengers came out as well as it did because the audiences actually got what they wanted from those characters, and he knew exactly what they should do. I would argue that in the case of Battleship, you had a capable director who can handle action, but you didn't give a crap about anybody on there. I defy you to tell me who any of those people were.
Oh, come on, you had Jesse Plemons as a junior petty officer, Rihanna as a plucky deck officer,
you had
Taylor Kitsch as a young officer given a battlefield promotion.
All in the mists of my memory now.
Look, I have a theory about how there are 2 kinds of action films. There's a pre-Enlightenment sky god model where Tony Stark or Thor flies down to save us, and then there's a post-Enlightenment, you know, blue-collar model, where the action film is just a bad day at work, and that's when you get your diehards and your better bonds. And I think Battleship is very much an action film that's a bad day at work, with all these normal people looking around going, what? Our shift? This couldn't have waited till tomorrow? Oh, rats. I much prefer it to be Avengers.
All right. At any rate, you are in the minority, sir.
It's a flag I wear proudly, quite frankly.
You are in the minority. That movie bombed. And yet, they needed it to fill the pipeline, to go out and feed their distribution deals around the world. It had a function there, all these ancillary markets where they wanted it to go. They needed something of that scale and that size at that time of year, and they let it go through, knowing that it would be terrible.
Well,
and that they would lose money.
First of all, it's still a pretty good movie. and the other thing is that, you know, it seems like our modern template seems to be give B movies A budgets.
Well, it's also give the foreign market this kind of relatively simple, relatively dialogue-free, relatively straightforward movie that doesn't necessarily play domestically anymore, and they don't care. And yeah, it's the American theaters that are suffering as a result of this. Although, so far, so good. You know, they're holding their own. It looks bad if you look at the reviews, if you
right.
look at how terrible the movies are. And yet, somehow, it's actually functioning.
There's one sentence in your book, well, there are several sentences in it that scare me, but the one that put a distinct chill down my spine was how perfectly you delineate how the number one foreign market for American films has gone from being Japan and is now China, which means that any studio executive in town can read that and go, oh, I have to start making films for the Chinese market that also play in North America. But that
is more and more the case.
But that means that we don't get, you know, films with leads of color. We don't get films with female leads because they won't play internationally. And worst of all, what if we start changing the values of our films because they might be discomfiting to an audience made up of people who gladly live under capitalist totalitarianism in China? That's the really scary part to me, is that in our hurry to export our cultural products, we forget what makes our culture.
This is true. And Hollywood has always been the most successful exporter of something that will play internationally, whereas it's very difficult for other countries and for China, especially, to figure out how to make movies that are going to play all over the world.
Well, I think that's one of the things I don't think that's a coincidence, though. I think that a level of artistic freedom and freedom of discourse is required to make engaging films, and I don't think China has that.
I agree. No, it certainly does not.
No.
And the problem in China. In fact, I was going to write a chapter about China, and I didn't. I reported it, and I couldn't. I just didn't have time. It was also one of those things where I needed so much more time to do more reporting to get a handle on it. I'm not sure I ever would have gotten a handle on it, but I actually have some ideas about what's wrong. And one of them is that the system they have there, they have no rating system. And therefore, SARFT, which is their board mm-hmm. that puts all the kibosh on so many plots and so many screenplays and says, no, you can't do this or that or that. The reason for that is that they're protecting every single Chinese person from a four-year-old to an ancient crone in a rural village.
But isn't that what the MPAA does already?
Not compared to that.
Well, I mean, Mark Twain is a great...
I am a defender of the MPAA, because the worst-case scenario in our country would be if you had local ordinances telling everybody what kind of movies they could have. That would be the alternative. The MPAA is a self-governing... I know that people want more freedom and more R ratings and NC-17s and everything else, and I know that it's imperfect, but it is, and I know that there are people who argue that it crushes creativity and so forth, but it's nothing compared to what the alternative would be.
I'm completely against the MPAA, primarily because in an era of disc and download and VOD and we're no longer communicating by telegraph. If I require information about whether or not a film is suitable for my children or for me, I can now acquire that information. I don't have to sit by the telegraph waiting for the news to come in from the scions of the MPAA. They're tougher on indie movies than they are on studio films.
I know.
They're tougher on sex than they are on violence.
I know.
They're utterly anonymous. It costs money to resubmit your film, which is something many indie films can't afford. And ultimately, it protects no one.
Well, indies can go unrated if they want to.
And then they can't advertise on the TV or be advertised in certain newspapers.
But indies probably wouldn't be doing that anyway.
Or booked into mall multiplexes, which are more and more of a concern. I just think that the MPAA is a great propaganda tool.
I don't see it that way at all. But compare to China. In China, there is no rating system.
Right.
And what they do there is they're basically protecting everyone from the four-year-old to the grandmother in the entire country, no matter how unsophisticated or sophisticated, with the same system, which is basically you can't have superstition, you can't have certain kind of religious things, you can't have too much violence, you can't have too much sex, you can't have any of those things ever.
Or in the case of A Touch of Sin, you can't comment upon the realities of our society and we'll let you make the film and
beyond,
then never release it.
Go into the politics too.
Yeah.
I mean, on the benevolent side, that's what they're protecting. They're a patriarchy that's trying to protect its people. That's a benevolent interpretation of what you're talking about. Of course, they do all sorts of horrible other things.
One of the smartest things I ever heard about film was this great casual throwaway line, actually from Wes Craven on the DVD commentary for Scream. And he was talking about getting blood and guts and gore and the fact that, oh, you meet this character and you like her and then she dies horribly. And his observation was that the MPAA would really like it if every film were an advertisement for the good life. And I really feel like that's true.
That sounds like Russia. That's Putin's deal.
Yeah, well,
he wants all the movies made in Russia to be propaganda machines for Russia. Unfortunately, he does want that.
Well, you know, it's not. But at the same time, it's not as if we kind of don't do that here. I mean, we're familiar with movies. Come on, everybody in a Disney rom-com in his apartment 12 times bigger than their actual salary could probably afford them, and selling a pernicious fantasy in and of itself.
Well, but what's going on with our culture, and by the way, I think it's terrible that Iron Man 3 or even worse, Django Unchained actually changed their edits in order to play in China.
Yeah.
And that's a disturbing thing. But the situation here is very interesting because you have this all or nothing kind of mentality that's really becoming quite firm. You have the tent poles up here and the little tiny micros down here, and very little in the middle that isn't perhaps slightly oriented toward the foreign market just to get funded. And so you have these formula movies and genre movies that are really boring. You have the huge, really bland, boring behemoths, and then you have all these little interesting sort of, you know, art films or arrival films that are young and often similar to each other, and very little room for the Wes Andersons of the world.
And that's deeply problematic. I always say that the biggest problem with the film industry right now is that it's turning into Brazil. Your movie will either cost $200 million or $200, and there's nothing in between. And that's not great for moviegoers, but I would also put that it's not great for filmmakers. I loved Colin Trevorrow's Safety Not Guaranteed.
Me too.
I would prefer it if he had a chance to get his feet wet on a slightly smaller film.
Than Jurassic Park 4,
you know? Or if he had the option to make a film that didn't have a Roman numeral attached to it. And I find that...
Well, he should be trained. He should be given the opportunity. Christopher Nolan got to make Insomnia. I'm not sure Insomnia would be made today.
Right.
He would be given Batman Begins when he didn't know how to make a big studio movie.
Hurry up with the cape, Pally. Quarterly stock report is coming.
So you end up with 47 Ronin,
right?
Which was by a neophyte who didn't know what he was doing and appeared to not be produced by anybody who knew what they were doing. So we have a situation where there's no proving ground, there's no farm system.
Yeah, and also a lot of these movies are built by design so that when you have the first film, it is so busy throat clearing for movies 2, 3, 4, and 5 that you never get an actual movie out of it. Certainly, a lot of people are saying that about Divergent, which I haven't seen yet. A lot of people said that about John Carter. I know it was a huge problem for Warner Brothers as Green Lantern. There's so much stuff bracing people for the inevitable success, they forget to make a film that can actually succeed.
Which is why I do write about Marvel
in
very glowing terms.
They
have figured it out somehow.
To a degree.
They are comparatively intelligent.
Well, I mean...
And long-sighted.
Yes. Well, I mean, comparing the Marvel film efforts to the DC film efforts is like, you know, an Olympian versus an asthmatic chain smoker. That DC just can't get out of their own way. And Marvel seems to be just trying things. And some of the movies are not, in fact, great.
But they keep themselves true to the world that they come from.
And a spirit and a tone, yes. And it's all very, very good.
And it's all consistent, and even, you know, I'm skeptical. I went to see Thor, and I loved it. I went to see Captain America, which wasn't one of the comics I particularly grew up with, and it was good.
Yeah, Captain America 2 is actually terrific, very much in the top third or quarter of those movies. It's well done, it moves swiftly, well-shot action, and because it's not a character who can shoot lightning out of her forehead, great close-quarter fight scenes, not quite of the caliber of a Raid 2, but still far better shot than in most other mainstream films. It completely works.
So you tell me, why can't we have more women action heroes? Why?
Well, here's the thing. I'm not the person who gets to make that call. And again, it's like we were saying before, the problem isn't what people would like to do. The problem is what people feel they have to do. There's this unaccepted shibboleth that a female action lead can't carry a film.
God. Now, may I posit Gravity?
May I posit The Hunger Games as well? And at the same time, those are action films, but they're well told and they have unique elements to them.
Kristen Stewart not the star of the Twilight series?
She was not. But those books are horrible.
I know they're horrible.
There's nothing in those books that's good for young ladies.
Those movies did very well, however.
Yes, but I mean, the thing is that they're completely immersed in incredibly retrograde sexual politics. Because it's all... The final film, or the second to last film, is 2 hours of people arguing whether Bella will not sleep with a vampire or not sleep with a werewolf. And I think, why don't you just say goodbye to both those jerks?
I was in Team Edward myself.
Oh, I was on Team When Will This End? It was interesting. I had a chance to talk to Stephanie Meyer about that, about the weirdly of a retrograde.
That was the reason it was so successful.
Ideas and politics, and she said, you know, the whole thing of Bella giving birth to a vampire. She said, you know, I just thought back to like the Civil War and pioneer times and women giving birth and how they could die, and I felt there was something heroic about that, and I really wanted to get back to that. And I thought if I were a horrible person, I would just write the headline, Stephanie Meyer finds medieval medical techniques, quote, you know, heroic. That just struck me as crazy.
No, but the truth of the matter is that she was in fact the star of an action franchise, and no one thinks that's true. You see, there's like this weird denial of the statistical facts. Of
50%
what
of the
true.
Audience is women.
Not a niche audience.
Not a niche audience, no. I also feel it's kind of like, you know, the fact is, again, people think, oh, if we can't make our money back, there's no reason to make this. The other thing that's great about The Hunger Games isn't just a female lead. It's that it completely avoids the two most tired tropes of most sagas. It avoids the... You are the chosen one.
Right, thank
and,
God.
And it also avoids the lame, tiresome father quest. The Hunger Games is about having a really crappy job for people you don't like. And that's what I really enjoy about it.
It's also about saving your family. And that's what women are allowed to be heroic for. If you're Linda Hamilton in the Terminator movies, if you're Ridley in Alien, you are saving the kid, you are saving the world, and you are allowed to be violent quest.
As part and parcel of that. Yeah, I just...
As opposed to men who could be violent whenever they fucking well please. Is this a problem?
I found that not to be the case for me. Mm. Normally I... You know what, I think you mean men on screen, yes? Yeah, I do think that. But I mean, at the same time, you watch something like Sleepless Night, that great French action film where it's a bad cop who has to go into a building full of drug dealers to save his kid. That has a paternal emotional touch that I really like in that movie. You know, Die Hard works not just because it's great action. It works because Bruce Willis kills a building full of terrorists to apologize to his ex-wife.
Exactly, and that was a brilliant move, and that's why Taken works, because Liam Neeson is trying to save his daughter.
Yeah.
There's a real mad dad going on there.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, if somebody smart is going to make a female-led action film that plays to and subverts everything we expect.
So what is it about, you know, the smart people in Hollywood who cannot figure out how to do Wonder Woman?
Their problem is that they're not smart enough to not realize that we're not dumb.
That is also true.
They have the lowest possible thoughts about us. And also, I think that with, say, for example, Wonder Woman, I think the problem is that you need to break that stuff away from X number of years of canon, in that I found Man of Steel most interesting where it deliberately stepped away from established canon to really make you think about the character.
It was quite dull.
I don't know what to tell you about that, but at least it wasn't hamstrung by 70 years of. The best line in The Avengers is when Captain America says, "There's only one God, ma'am, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that." A theological note you would never see in 70 years of Marvel Comics, but that on screen works perfectly. I think they need to break out of the IP straitjacket and play with this stuff a little bit, you know? But again, we're sort of, you know, a room full of lions is not an ecology. You know, there has to be smaller things and ecological niches and medium things and what have you.
And I'm arguing that this wholesale flight to television is the result of this industry, you know, almost imploding on itself. I mean, you can look at it like the studios are sort of facades, you know, and they're kind of getting smaller and smaller behind that shiny exterior.
The big gate, yeah. And in back of it is nothing but cobwebs.
It's a little bit the Wizard of Oz.
Potemkin Village,
classically. And I, you know, they're still churning out these, but there are fewer of them. Fewer movies are being made, and there's fewer executives, and there's, you know, they're coming closer to being smaller than they've ever been, and heading in the direction of television is all that talent you were talking about who can't get arrested. Right now.
You know, Lynn Shelton directing episodes of Mad Men or Girls because, you know, in between finding financing for her films.
And Agnieszka Holland and all these other people. Exactly. And Steven Soderbergh turning his back forever on movies, saying, "I'm just going to make them for TV." Now, other people argue, like the other night at this thing where I had John Horne and Kim Masters and I were talking.
Very lively
really
discussion.
Fun,
yeah.
Really fun. But just filmed entertainment. Why are you making these distinctions between movies and television? And, you know, it's all one now. It's all one flow. It's all one universe. And I find, I don't want to feel like some old-fashioned, you know, diehard here, you know, fighting for the health of movies. Movies should still exist.
I would love it if going to the theater weren't something like swing dancing or quilting or some silly niche thing that oldsters did.
Yes.
But I think that, you know, one of the big problems is that, you know, tentpoleitis is killing movie going, and the way we currently do our Oscar season does not help at all.
You have a particular approach to that. I would argue that we should spread them out over the year, absolutely.
Yep.
And it doesn't, you know, Blue Jasmine got in there, whether it opened in July or you know, in December. But it's tougher. It is tougher for the film.
It just hyper-contracts everything.
But Wes Anderson's movie, I will argue, The Grand Budapest Hotel, will be in the Oscar race at the end of the year, even if it came out this early.
And despite the fact that it doesn't deserve to. My feelings about The Grand Budapest Hotel are weirdly the same as my feelings about Soderbergh's Contagion, which is that I enjoy the pace, but I can name actors in it more easily than I can name characters. I admire its verve more than I'm actually emotionally engaged in it. And also, I think that making a wacky candy-colored farce about, you know, the spasms of fascism and communism rippling across Europe, you know, ask somebody who lived through that if they appreciated the aspect ratio changes or the changes in the color palette at that time.
You're being very serious about this.
I think
that the movie is a delightful escape, and he's created this world that is not nearly as dour as the Stefan Zweig world that inspired it.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you have comedy Nazis showing up called the Zigzags, I don't think Nazis are always funny, or if they are, you have to be really good at it, like, you know, in Inochka, or that's Russians, but the Jack Benny to be or not to be. I think you need that kind of touch.
I thought he pulled it off.
And I was like, this is a delightful iteration of something I've seen you do before.
I disagree. I think he took it to a new level. I think it's funnier. I think it's got more action. I think it's broader.
Did you see that Saturday Night Live sketch for the Wes Anderson horror film when Edward Norton was hosting? And it was Wes Anderson's new horror film, The Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders. And it was Edward Norton in an Owen Wilson way going, oh, wow, we got letters from people who want to come and kill us. Oh, it's a communique. And as much as I laugh, because it's nearly perfect, I thought, I would love to see that. I would love to see Wes Anderson do something, anything other than the rut he's in now, and also get him outside. My favorite Wes Anderson films are the ones where he doesn't quite have the money to choke the life out of everything with set design. You know, there are exteriors in Rushmore and Bottle Rocket and The Royal Tenenbaums and The Darjeeling Limited. There aren't in a lot of his lesser films.
I love that funicular. That's my...
It's a cute funicular. It made me want to go down to Angel's Flight and to say the word funicular as much as possible. But I just felt like I was inside the snow globe yet again, perfectly sealed and full of tiny sparkly things. And, you know, that's probably a $30 million movie, which alone makes it worthy of respect and awe. It's like seeing a unicorn at Safeway.
Now, certain directors have the ability to push these things through. They can be the exceptions that prove the rule, and they can get financed.
But not when you have, I mean, Focus Features is disappearing or being
agglomerated.
Fox Searchlight is still in it to win it,
absolutely,
smaller movies. But we are seeing fewer and fewer of those smaller $30 million film distributors.
And it's riskier, you know, when you make those films. So it's. But that's why we're happy the Grand Budapest Hotel is a huge box office success already and will hopefully continue to be.
I'm happy for any medium-sized movie if it does well. I just did not especially like Grand Budapest Hotel. With that said, how much of a book got, you know, with a great classic phrase in journalism, OTBE, overtaken by events? After you went to press, afterward in the book is October 2013, after you went to press, did anything happen? You went, oh my God, I can't believe the damn thing's locked.
Yeah, I worked on that afterward pretty recently. It all seems to be the Netflix of it all is rushing forward, you know, very quickly, I would say.
Terms of as a distribution pipeline or...
Or the Veronica Mars thing that just happened this past... You know, there's movement in the same areas. The whole idea of how VOD distribution and data... This whole drama that's playing out. The indies are innovating, the studios are watching, and they want to get into it, but they have to respect the relationship with the exhibitors. You know, the end of 35... The digitalization of everything, the rise of, you know, I could have put in, you know, more examples of how the new distribution paradigm is playing out, where you have a website and you can skip a lot of the middle people and you don't sell your rights and you actually click on buy this video.
Yeah, Louis C.K. did a great job of that with no DRM and a very affordable price point. Apple's iTunes is having a big effect on that in terms of people being able to go, oh, this new VOD film, click, and it's on my television.
Right.
The one thing that both Netflix and Apple do brilliantly is bridge the computer to couch gap.
Yes.
And they do that superlatively. One of my favorite horror films from last year was on iTunes, never had distribution, a $6,000 zombie film called The Battery. It played like the end of the world as written as an 80s John Sayles flick.
How did you find it is the question.
I had read good things about it on the Miracle Bon Mot machine we call Twitter, Anne. And the fact that it was $9 didn't make it seem like too much of an annoyance. I watched a trailer and I enjoyed it. And then when I watched a film, again, it's a zombie film, but the dialogue feels like a John Sayles movie. It's about these two co-workers after the zombie apocalypse who still kind of don't like each other. You know, and I was completely compelled by that. At the same time, that never got picked up. And maybe it doesn't have to, but if there's one thing studios are still good for, it's publicity and advertising.
That is the gap that I feel is really a question mark.
Yeah.
For all the, you know, you need the festivals to curate and to find a lot of those movies and introduce them to us. That's how most people find them, I think. But, and then the Twitter feed... From the festivals and everything, but you know, it's really difficult for those films to get branded and to get reviewed You know, that's the kind of thing you need.
Well, a lot of the problem with that is just elephantiasis of a festival, which seems to be going on more, in that I can only think of one outlet that covered every film at Sundance and Slamdance this year, and that's Film Threat. I'm not sure if even IndieWire did that. No. And you know, it's not Manola Dargis's infamous Too Many Movies piece, you know. There are too many independent movies.
Very much from her own point of view, which she should never have said, you know, don't buy any movies at Sundance. That was a very catchy.
It sounded like Emperor and Amadeus going, too many notes.
I know, but she comes from a place of the reason she wrote that was that she's the New York Times has to review about 900 movies in the course of a year because of these arcane deals that trigger
four-walling,
all the
qualifying
other,
rounds, etc.
Exactly. And so those are the deals that are sort of out of time.
Well, God forbid the Times hire more writers.
They do. They hire a slew of them. And I challenge anyone to admit that they've read every review every Friday of all the movies that, you know, I mean, I don't. I skip over them. It's really bad.
But, I mean, the only way to stand athwart the tide of creation is through curation, right?
That is the new mantra. And we will see.
We will see. I mean, it's weird that in America, if you know what you're talking about when it comes to sports, they give you a radio program and a nickname after some kind of animal. In America, if you know what you're talking about movies, people say, oh, shut up, big head. I don't know where that comes from. I really don't. It's strange to me, you know.
Well, I'm feeling a little disturbance in the force when it comes to some of my favorite writers losing their jobs. You know, it feels like a lot of the outlets,
getting booted out of Huffington Post, Glenn Kenny getting booted at MSN Movies, along with a few other people who happen to be speaking right now.
I know.
I mean, it's.
And Matt Patches was employed and is now freelancing.
Yeah,
you know, it's a little disturbing.
And well, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, A, the jobs are going away, and B, when you get the job, it may not be the job you in fact want to do. I mean, I was saying that as a freelancer, I wait for checks. I wait to see if things will happen. Stories get spiked. Things just don't occur.
Editors move around.
Editors move around.
The person who was hiring you is no longer there.
Right, but I don't have to write about Shia LaBeouf's apology art installation piece.
When I freelanced, one of the things that it taught me was what I liked doing.
Right.
And I had the ability to say no.
But at the same time, if you're someone who likes writing a full-length review, which combines appreciation of art and consumer advocacy about whether or not the movie is any darn good, a lot of editors don't want that these days. They like lists. They like brackets. They like quizzes.
They're paying attention to
the
traffic.
They like galleries.
And everybody has to pay attention to traffic if they're going to survive, and it's a real problem.
Yeah, I do not like that.
Everybody's attention span appears to be dwindling. Although there
what
is...
What were you saying?
The attention...
No, I'm kidding.
So the idea is that there is some evidence, though, that long-form pieces do have a life and have a long tail, and that there are readers for them. How to get them to read them is the question.
I think it's a significant generational shift in that I grew up in the age of print newspapers, print magazines, good old-fashioned books. And the great thing about getting the New York Times isn't just that it's stories about what you're interested in. It's stories that a reasonably intelligent person thinks a reasonably intelligent person should be interested in. And you're exposed to this random piece of information that you then have to think about and improves your life. On the web, you can just go down this endless rabbit hole of links pursuing only your concerns in that primitive dopamine jolt way.
You will note that there,
oh my God.
There's some old media here.
There's a stack
here.
Of magazines of thickness of my forearm over there, and that's great. I still love them.
I did abandon the newspapers, though.
Yes,
that I cannot do anymore.
It's a lot of wood pulp.
I do it on the thing.
I did the Sunday Times for a while. I'll still do it occasionally. But I get the New Yorker. I get Entertainment Weekly. I would love it if there were an intelligent magazine about film aimed at consumers in the States, like Empire or Total Film in the UK.
I regret that Premiere did not survive. It was badly published. It did not need to happen. I hope EW survives. They've got this new guy in charge. I'm a little nervous.
And then the other thing is that, like, the celebrity industrial complex is also killing movies. In that, you know, it's not, oh, Maleficent, that might be good. But, oh, Angelina Jolie looks really creepy. And the Oscars, again, are designed to make you think more about people's dresses than their films. I friends of mine call me Jumpsuit Jones because I would love it if that was all people got to wear.
No.
But
no.
I do feel
I am not going to. No. The glamour, there is still, you know, we still need movie stars, we still need glamour, and we still need the Oscars. The Oscars, I will argue, actually allow a certain number of films to be made and promoted that might not otherwise exist, and therefore we should support them.
See, I think the Oscars exist so that we can all go batshit crazy for 8 months because Harvey Weinstein had a bad experience at prom. I mean, like, am I supposed to see the making of Philomena as a triumph, that the award system somehow enables this tepid piece of tedium that's inferior to the Magdalene sisters in every way? I just don't know what the Oscars are for, aside from meaningless competition. And
that movie did perfectly well at the box office. There was an audience for it. It got a lot bigger, that audience, as a result of some of the advertising that Harvey employed in services.
Yes, but when
chasing an Oscar.
When
and
Rex Reed calls something a perfect film.
Is it a relatively soft, middle brow, you know, movie aimed at older viewers? Yeah, but that's okay. There's room for that.
Yeah, see, I just find that the Oscars and even the Independent Spirit Awards are just this string of broken systems that do the active opposite of what they're supposed to do.
I would argue that the spirits need to rejigger their rules and lower the budget standards.
How far would you drop it?
15. So that they don't overlap with
Five.
The Oscars. No, then it would be too small. But if the lowest budget Oscar contenders are still inside the radius of the Independent Spirit Awards, they're going to win them all. And that's been happening year after. Now, the Year of the Artist, it should never have been eligible. That was a Harvey move, and they folded and caved. There's a French movie. Come on.
Yeah.
It was financed by Wild Bunch. It was completely French, even if it had Americans in it. It is, and it was shot here. But that was a French movie, and therefore you had this duplicative, boring thing. And this year, the same thing happened. But you know,
I think maybe ten.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, it's like when it's Upstream Color gets nominated for Best Director and Best Editing, which to me are two of the things that define, oh, I don't know, a film. And meanwhile, over in Best Picture, you know, it's shoved out by things like, you know, Inside Llewyn Davis. Inside Llewyn Davis. And Inside Llewyn Davis is a lovely film. I'm not sure the indie spirit should be rewarding plucky upstarts like the Coen brothers. the indie spirits are damnably broken, and the Oscars are even worse. What good do they do, Anne?
They really do make it possible for a lot of these movies to get made because there's some hope that they will actually be highlighted and focused on and promoted, and that the fact that they actually are in this thing that goes on for too long, I grant you. This year it went on longer because of the Olympics, and next year it'll be shorter again. But look, I'm
not
more...
Not short.
You
enough.
Know who you're talking to. I mean, I'm a professional Oscar prognosticator. It's my job. It's part of what pays the bills.
I understand
what
that.
What am I going to do?
I always say that being an Oscar prognosticator is like being an election pundit in Iran. You know, you can be really good at it, but it's still a very strange system. And I say this with love and regard for you,
and
because it's
and
the Academy.
I'm so glad it's over. I'm so glad. I am in recovery. There are people putting, because they're chasing traffic, there are people putting up, you know, early, you know, predictions. I am not going near that thing. If there's some people in, if some movies in Cannes, yeah, sure, I'll say it. But until then, my Oscar predictions are closed.
And the other thing is that there are Oscar prognosticators who are worth reading because of their insight and their passion and their understanding. Greg Elwood, Tom O'Neill's charm, for example. But there are other people who are less worthy of regard and who really seem to just glom on to the whole spotlight and charm of it really fiercely.
Well, part of what happens is that when, you know, this is something I learned a long, long, long time ago. You know, if you write about the Oscars and the Oscar race, they will come. You know, it's old. I mean, it's always been a magnet for people who love movies, who love to get into this discussion. And it's too many people filed into the room, you know, with their you know, chasing traffic and crazy headlines. So-and-so is going to be, you know, in the race. It's ridiculous.
I mean, you look at what happens to a movie like Labor Day, which is ostensibly supposed to be a big Oscar contender and debuts at Toronto, and then...
Now that's a case where Jason Reitman has a... Darren Aronofsky has a thing for Venice. You know, he thinks it's his good luck charm.
Right.
Jason thinks Telluride is his good luck charm. So he always goes back to Telluride.
Yeah.
And Labor Day never should have been in the Oscar race. But the studio was humoring him. The studio, Fox, was humoring Ben, you know, because Walter Mitty, Stiller.
Right.
They were humoring him. He's a big star. He thought he'd made a good one, and they wanted to support him. And so it never should have opened at the New York Film Festival.
How much of Hollywood would collapse if people just talked to each other honestly for a day? Not even unkindly, just, Mr. Stiller, we're like the film, we're proud to put it out. It is by no means an Oscar contender. We don't have $100,000 to spend on for-your consideration ads.
If Tom Rothman were still there, that conversation might have occurred.
Right.
You know, we'll see what happens when Stacey Snyder gets over there, if and when that happens.
How much, another great thing you do in the book, the $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system, out now, you sort of delineate which studios have franchises and which don't. And it really struck a chord. I was thinking earlier this year, I would hate to be Universal because you have...
Well, Fast and Furious is doing okay.
Yeah, you have three franchises. You have Fast and Furious, which just lost one of its members in a tragic accident. You have Riddick, which does not necessarily perform well. And you have Bourne, where you can't even get the original lead back. If you're Universal, you're not really playing on the board with the stuff you need to win.
That's why they keep going back to their monster movies, you know?
Right.
You know, trying to do the Wolfman, which didn't work.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's sad, but they're the weakest ones. But on another level, they're the ones because they're owned by Comcast, who may be able to make the transition more efficiently into the future in a funny way.
Is it a whole thing of eventually it'll just be, you know, Warner Brothers, Time Warner, Comcast, Universal, Disney/Apple, that the trick will not just be owning the content, but owning the pipeline?
That's right, and that's where Sony looks like a bit of a weaker link, you know, in that scenario.
Have you tried Crackle?
No.
The Crackle is Sony's proprietary, this is our stuff, streaming service. And you can get it on your tablet, you can get it on some of your connected devices, and it's got some new programming, like, for example, Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, which for me is perfect television. But all this Sony stuff, film, movies, lives there and there alone. And I'm really wondering why more studios aren't doing that.
Well, they've got this sort of ultraviolet thing, which doesn't seem to be working very well.
Which nobody likes.
Part of the culprit with Veronica Mars not being delivered properly for the Kickstarter people. Well, when they get together, the studios, when they try to do things together, they tend to be very, very conservative. And they don't think of... It's very interesting. They don't think about consumers the way companies like Amazon do. You know?
Enlighten me. And, please go on.
What I mean by that is that they think it's their job to be the person up on high from above that says, you will do this because I'm paying for you to buy this.
Right.
You, I'm advertising this to you, the stupid consumer, and you're going to do what I tell you. And they've been accustomed to using all this money and this extraordinary power to get them to do what they want, and they're not doing it anymore. Necessarily.
Especially
the young men. You know, that target audience that they insist on.
And as you point out in, you know, the book so extraordinarily well, Hollywood's pursuit of young men is semi-suicidal because of all the possible niche markets they're the ones with the greatest number of other distractions.
Correct.
They're the people who are more likely to blow off a movie for UFC, or a night in playing video games, or an evening of sporting events, or whatever it is that real men do. I wouldn't know. But the idea that Hollywood is so intent on earning the dollars of a demographic that seems to be abandoning it is pretty strange.
Yeah, but they've been so accustomed to thinking we can sell to the young and stupid, you know, that it's difficult for them. It's difficult for them to have a high bar of execution. You know, that they have to deliver something of high quality. They hate that. But that's what's going on. They're having to take each of these sort of, you know, take the movie like the Brad Pitt.
World War Z, as they call it in Canada?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm losing my brain cells now. Taking World War Z and just, you know, reshooting the last half hour completely and fixing it and making it better. I liked that movie at the end. I thought it was a very good movie. But it was a very laborious, a very expensive process to get it to where it needed to be. And they keep sending their movies back to the editing room for fixes because they can't get away with it.
And they wind up smeared with fingerprints. I mean, it's a whole thing for me of when I'm watching a bad film, the joke is, who wrote this crap? But the better question is, who read it? Who read this and went, oh, let's move forward?
Don't I know.
Is there anyone at a movie studio who can actually read a script and determine if it'll have a functioning storyline? Or do they just find these things with large enough names, they figure those will block up the gaps in it?
Well, they try to do stars, they try to do visual effects, they try to do branded, you know, names that they can rely on. If this is, you know, from a video game, this is from, you know, a board game. but when they are in search of a story is when they're in trouble, you know. At least with the Marvel Universe, that IP thing works in their favor. Those are established characters that everybody loves already.
And you have 70 years of a back catalog
Correct.
To raid for gems.
For fabulous plots. Yeah, no, it's all good. But what's gone, which I decry, is the original. People forget that Avatar was an original, that there was a period of time where everybody was panicking that Avatar was going to bomb.
Because nobody knew what
it was, and the blue aliens didn't look good in the trailers. And
I just keep on remembering that when it came out, Star Wars was a $10 million movie. You know, they thought, oh, summertime trash, if it's no good, we'll just scrap it and sell the special effects back. And the thing is that I want to know what the equivalent of that movie would be, because I don't think we're getting it.
That's exactly right. And it's hard to remember that The Matrix was an original, that Die Hard was an original,
theoretically based on a novel, but...
Okay, yeah. Forget Die Hard. Die Hard. The Matrix was an original, and I think the other one that was an original was Lethal Weapon.
Yep.
You know, that you have to come up with these. You have to imagine them. You have to, and then when the only region of our Hollywood ecosystem that seems to be original still, comedies.
Yes.
And animated movies, which are the most lucrative, the most successful niche that we have, and they're originals.
At the same time, you had Pixar announcing just today that we're going to see Cars 3 and The Incredibles 2,
which I look forward to.
Which is the definition of a delightful drink served in
to.
A rancid coconut shell.
They would be stupid. But what's really interesting about Pixar, and I am a huge, huge, huge believer in Pixar and in the genius of John Lasseter, but it is interesting to me that he has taken, you know, the Disney people brought him indoors, inside the Mouse House. They made him head not only of Pixar, but of Disney Animation as well. And he's being a responsible studio executive at the expense of a
boring.
Lot of originality. I know.
Deeply
I
boring.
Know. When
and
they're original, they're still good.
I was on a press tour for a Pixar film, and I sidled up to the one director, and I said, hey, you know, Lasseter always says we think of animation as a medium, not a genre. But are there people lined up outside his office going, I really want to make Catherine Dunn's Geek Love for grown-ups, or I want to make a PG-13, possibly soft R science fiction epic. Are those people lined up? And that director said, God, no, Lasseter would never do anything like that. If it's bright and shiny and made for kids, Lasseter's in. And that's when I think, yeah, maybe then it's time to step down.
I don't think so. I think he's got a lot of good. Frozen is wonderful.
No, Frozen is adequate. It's the story is such a jumble. I don't know why I should care about any of these characters. The songs are murky.
It's a musical. It's a sister story. It's set in this wonderful Nordic universe.
It was going to be called The Snow Queen until people realized that you know, nobody wants to see a movie with a title with a princess or queen in the title.
It's about princesses.
But there's so many compromises baked into it from a jump.
I thought it was wonderful. I thought it's the best thing they've done in decades. I really do.
Really?
I will argue that, you know, the second I heard that song, Let It Go, I knew that it would win the Oscar. I knew that the movie was going to be the one to beat for the Oscar. It is that good. I'm not saying that those things define its goodness, but they're indicative of a general love for that movie and admiration.
I just keep on thinking that DreamWorks Animation is a deeply spotty record, but they do things with How to Train Your Dragon that you would never see in a Disney film. And that, to me, is what makes that movie really special, is the fact that How to Train Your Dragon is like this big, animated, beautifully shot epic about peace and forgiveness and reconciliation and its cost, and bad things happen to nice people.
When DreamWorks does good movies, they're really good. And I love that film, and I also loved The Croods, which didn't seem to get enough respect last year, although it was nominated.
I took a look at The Croods, and I went, I can't dig that aesthetic.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. I completely loved it.
Now and then, DreamWorks makes movies that should seem fine, but are deeply ugly in their character design.
Well, I hated Megamind. The Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Oh, I did not mind that quite so much.
Oh, I hated that.
Huh. It has a bit of a nemesis problem.
It was totally not as witty and smart and lovely as the cartoon I grew up with. That was my
It's very strange because I always keep on imagining what defrosted severed head from somebody who died in 1970 do they keep unthawing to get the idea for who is crying out for Mr. Peabody and Sherman to come back.
Well, that's the thing. They're I'm the target audience
right.
for that movie, and that didn't work.
Right. What to you, do you predict a year when, just based on what's in production now, everything's going to fall apart, i.e., there'll be so many $100 million plus movies released that no one will get a satisfactory slice of a pie to continue? Have we hit peak blockbuster?
I think that's going to happen year after year, and somehow they keep somehow churning forward. It hasn't, I mean, that year, 2013, the one right after 2012, when Spielberg had predicted the six disasters, mm-hmm. they did occur.
Yeah.
And they were bad. And now there hasn't been a disaster that has destroyed a studio yet.
Yet.
Yeah. And,
but, I mean, turning studios is like turning an aircraft carrier. It takes time and it takes energy
and
it takes effort.
Well, they hedge their bets. They have lots of investors. You know, they don't take on the cost.
Thanks for Pacific Rim, Thomas Toll. Thanks so much for Pacific Rim,
they
legendary.
They don't take it all on themselves. So they manage to mitigate those. But Disney took two write-offs above $200 million.
John Carter and?
And the other one was Lone Ranger. That was like a 190.
Yeah. You saw Lone Ranger.
I actually liked Lone Ranger. But there's no justification for that cost.
There's no justification for... And also,
there was no justification for thinking that it would be a commercial movie.
And for thinking that it should exist.
Exactly. But
yeah.
I happen to be a Buster Keaton Western fan.
Right.
So I happen to enjoy a lot of what they were doing and understand what they were doing and get it aesthetically. I don't think... You know, and I remember when the William Tell overture comes on, I remember what it meant.
It just if it means that we get fewer Transformers films, then I'm kind of happy about Jerry Bruckheimer's Fall from Grace. Is that wrong to say?
No, his time had come.
Yeah.
His time had come. And he was in a box, though. I mean, that was part of the problem. He was trying to do this at Disney. His real sensibility is not, you know, they've become, they're... their default setting has gotten smaller and more family oriented and more brand Disney brand oriented, you know. So they didn't need him anymore. They had Marvel, they have Pixar, they have, I mean, I'm a little worried about the future of DreamWorks too.
Yeah. If you were to pick a story that's happened since the book in terms of exciting things that turn stuff around, would it be Annapurna? I mean, there's some Annapurna and Megan Ellison stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's exciting in the sense that she seems to be a producer with taste, you know, who's willing to put her money on the right things.
Yeah.
And she's done remarkably well.
Zero Dark Thirty, The Master, a bunch of stuff.
Including the two Oscar contenders this year, Her and American Hustle.
Yeah.
And it's funny to see, you know, she doesn't like to do publicity. She has not sat down for an interview yet. She's like 27 years old, and she goes to parties. She goes to the premieres of her films. She goes to the Oscars, and it's fun to watch people sort of chasing after her because, of course, everyone's fantasy is that they'll pay for their movie.
Right.
And she actually has readers galore. I mean, there are stacks of scripts at Annapurna waiting for her.
Do we need more tech billionaire children getting in? That was going to save Hollywood, a trickle-down effect of Silicon Valley money
there
coming down
been,
here?
There have been a lot of people like this in Hollywood. Very few of them have demonstrated consistent taste like this. And I find that very interesting in her case. They usually go, in her case, she's going for the movies that need help. They usually go for Terminator movies like her brother.
Right,
you know?
Right. That Skydance, which is doing rather well at the same time. What is going to be the big story of the next calendar year?
I am waiting for the Netflix of it all and the Amazon of it all. Amazon and iTunes and Hulu and Google and Apple, all of these companies are the real giants that are going to be challenging Hollywood. And I'm waiting for the cracks to emerge. You know, to see whether some of these facades start to fall down,
or also to see if, you know, if some of these newer creators' lucky streaks continue. I mean, what will Netflix do with their first bomb? Will they be able to absorb it?
What's interesting about that is that I think that the $100 million they spent on House of Cards was the typical kind of, hey guys, we're planting a flag here. David Fincher is on our side.
Yes, but
you
so is Joel
follow,
Schumacher.
You yeah. can follow him. So in this case, they will never spend that kind of money again.
Right.
And that was a lost leader.
Yeah.
And it turned out that they got plenty of subscribers, and they're growing, and everything's working, and the Arrested Development and Orange is the New Black and so forth. And I'm looking forward to finishing season 2, which I have not done.
Of House of Cards? I'm going to, spoiler alert, Kevin Spacey is awful. But I feel like you already know that. Is there anything on TV you're watching right now that you can't get enough of?
Well, I'm behind on everything because I was sort of crazy with all the Oscars and South by Southwest and book launch and all this crazy stuff. So I'm behind on True Detective, Justified, Girls, and Nashville. And I watch a lot of television. I do.
I have Hulu, and I was just joking the other day that
The Americans.
Yeah, I love The Americans because it perfectly taps into my Cold War childhood, and because it has plenty of wigs, and because of the idea of a marriage being a conspiracy in and of itself is really hilarious. That, and I was talking to my wife saying, it's really funny to me how on The Americans, Ronald Reagan is like the big bad hovering over everything. And she said, well, he's your big bad, too, so you should really like it. But I do. I've been really enjoying Hannibal, which is another great example of international co-financing, making a project possible that would have been unthinkable years ago.
And it's turning our bud, Mads Mikkelsen, into a true star.
I love
him.
Crazy real star.
Love him.
Yes, and I really, really like True Detective, and I hope they do something different with it next time.
I loved that thing that went, that took over Twitter for a period, where everybody was posting pictures of who would be the next duo.
Bert and Ernie.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, Lady Gaga and Robin. Yeah. William Goss and Guy Lodge. Yes. I myself would vote for John Sayles and Angela Bassett for True Detective Season 2. I would watch a bejabers out of that. Finally, one final question. What's the best movie in theaters right now? Would you say Grand Budapest? You're nodding, but that doesn't work so well on a podcast. Could you?
I would say that the movie I saw this morning is going to be the best one, Nymphomaniac, Volume 1. I loved this movie. I love Lars von Trier movies. I am always... He's one of these filmmakers like, I don't know, Robert Altman or Ken Russell. I mean, he's crazy. And he's brilliant, and he's got the chops to pull you into this sort of bizarre universe that he creates each and every time. And this one is utterly compelling, and occasionally sexy, but not that sexy.
Yeah, this doesn't strike me as something you would watch for prurient interest.
Not at all.
It seems too grim for that.
Not at all. But it's mostly Stellan Skarsgård and Charlotte Gainsbourg as she tells her... I loved it, and I can't wait to see Volume 2.
There was this great Mark Olson of the LA Times is joking that he's been singing Nymphomaniac to the tune of Michael Sambello's Maniac from Flashdance, but he didn't have a first verse, and my joke was, she's a small-town girl who will pay for her sins. I mean, I kind of like that slightly lightly punishing aspect of von Trierism. So Nymphomaniac and the Grand Budapest Hotel in theaters or on demand, two very different trips through Europe, as endorsed by Ann Thompson.
Thank you, James.
Our guest this week on the Lunch Podcast has been Ann Thompson. You can find her blog, Thompson on Hollywood, at IndieWire. Also, right now in bookstores or via electronic device, you can read her superb book, The $11 Billion Year, From Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at a changing Hollywood system. You could not ask for a more convivial, knowledgeable, or passionate tour guide through what is often a glass-bottom trip through a sewer, but often a discussion of the highest levels of art. You can find Anne on Twitter at AK Stanwyck. I'm your regular host, James Rocky, and you can find this podcast at The Lunch Podcast on Twitter. Anne, thanks again for joining us and everyone out there in podcast land. Until we talk again, go to the movies, have a meal afterwards, talk with your friends. It's a good thing. We'll be right back.
overdone.